I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. It's always good to catch up with you.
For every commercial investor, having a tenant ongoing in a property is vital. However, it's always intrigued me as to the actual process for when the tenant leaves at the end of a lease. Could you perhaps walk us through that?
Yeah, you know, Ken, I can understand that because a lot of people do get a little confused as to what the procedure is when a tenant vacates. And depending upon what your lease specifies upon termination, the cost to make good the property can vary dramatically. And furthermore, the tenancy fit out and its original condition when the tenant went in there can also affect that cost as well. Maybe if we start by looking at office tenancies, and depending on the quality of finish involved, you'll need to allow somewhere between $70 and $180 per square metre, depending upon whether you need to replace the carpets, remove fixed partitioning and carry out significant repairs. And other things to consider are the need to reinstate sprinklers, lighting and power outlets to restore the tenancy to an open plan layout ready for the new tenant to come in and do whatever they need to do as far as their own office layout. So when it comes to industrial properties, here you could be looking at anywhere from $20 to $160 per square metre, again, depending on the level of the fixed partitioning and things like contamination caused by the tenant's operations. Plus, there could be damage to the concrete floors beyond what's called normal wear and tear, which is accepted by law under the lease as being reasonable, which you then need to repair, and that can be expensive. So hence the wide range. But generally, it's probably in the $20 to $80, maybe $100 a square metre. When it comes to retail tenancies, most incoming retail tenants prefer a bare shell, and that's so that they can undertake their own fit out to reflect the nature and image of the business. And therefore, the cost to completely remove an outgoing tenant's fit out could amount to somewhere between $400 and $500 per square metre when you take into account things like the tiled flooring, fixed shelving, equipment and the like, and then having to reinstate all the facilities and like electricity and so forth so that the next tenant can take it from that point and do what they need to do for their own fit out. So the question comes back to what generally happens in practice. What you'll find is that most leases require the tenant to actually do the make good. And therefore, the only area of dispute, apart from the cost, will be the actual condition of the tenancy at the start of the lease. Now, ideally, you should hold a copy of an ingoing condition report from the beginning of the tenancy. But more often than not, after a long tenancy where they might have exercised a couple of options, very seldom will you be able to find it. So it'll generally come down to a negotiated settlement. So what you find is that you're actually in a better position if you accept a cash payment from the tenant by way of settlement in lieu of them actually physically making good. Now, the reason for that is that your new tenant may well be able to adapt or modify some of the existing fit out, and you could then offer part of the cash payment you received by way of an upfront incentive. And as you can appreciate, this is a complex area of tenant relations and one where you really need to get the right advice, preferably from the start of any new lease that you enter into. But you need to get what's called a dilapidation report at the end of the tenancy. And again, a quantity surveyor will probably provide that to you. And that's the point of negotiation with the tenant. Invariably, that's at the top end of the range. They'll obviously offer much less, and you'll probably settle somewhere in the middle. But the reality is, as I was saying, you don't necessarily have to go back to scratch because much of the tenancy fit-out, particularly with offices, can be reused and it's not so much reinstating the tenancy back to its original position, but modifying what's there to suit the incoming tenant.
Obviously, that money you spend on renovating the property is tax deductible or can be depreciated over time. Could you possibly explain some of the common misunderstandings or myths surrounding depreciation?
Look, depreciation is probably one of the most misunderstood parts of commercial property as far as investors are concerned. It's a weapon that you can legitimately use to shelter a significant portion of your property income. And as you say, there are a few myths. There's probably four main myths that are keeping you from maximising your tax advantages. Now, as a commercial property investor, you really do have an unfair advantage over someone investing only in residential property. And so it's probably worth, if we have a look at a few of these common myths, and let's see if we can dispel them as far as depreciation is concerned. Myth number one is that your accountant calculates your depreciation claim. Now, that's not correct. Your accountant is the one who lodges your claim. What you need to do is to engage a quantity surveyor who will prepare a tax depreciation schedule which details everything your accountant can claim on your behalf. Now, the second myth is that the tax schedule needs to be prepared as soon as you buy the property. Now, again, that's not correct. There's no mad rush. The surveyor will apportion your claim back to the date of purchase so that the actual preparation of the tax depreciation schedule itself is not at all time critical. However, the surveyor's fee, when it's done, will be totally tax deductible. And so if you pay that before the 30th of June in any one year, you can claim it in that financial year. The third myth is that you cannot adjust your earlier tax returns. And again, that's not true. If you haven't fully claimed your entitlement over the past four financial years, then generally you can seek an amendment in your favour. Now, again, your accountant simply uses the tax depreciation schedule created in demolishing those earlier myths to make the adjustment in your next tax return. And the final one is that with every commercial property you buy, you are able to claim depreciation benefits irrespective of its age, because most people feel if it's an old property, you can't therefore claim the full amount. Now, it simply comes down to how you structure the purchase contract as to exactly how much you're entitled to upvalue the plant and articles, which are the highly depreciable component of the property that you've just purchased. Now, when I say structure the contract, what I'm talking about is that you have to ensure that the contract does not contain a written down value schedule of all those highly depreciable items, the plant and equipment. Because if it does, you have to work from that written down value. If it doesn't, you can upvalue the plant and articles and re-depreciate them at their higher price or higher value. Now, it's a simple formula. I don't want to get too technical, but what you do is you have your purchase price or your contract price, you subtract the value of the land, because that's obviously not depreciable, which leaves you with the building component. That is then split by the quantity surveyor into the structure, which is an estimate of what it cost to build at the day it was built, and the plant and articles, which is simply subtracting the cost of the structure from what the building component was. So you can see that as the purchase price increases, because the structure is a fixed cost because it's set at a date, the value of the plant and articles can actually be upvalued to present day value. So what it means is that your structural component, which is called a Division 43, is depreciated over 40 years, so it's 2.5% per annum. However, the plant and articles, which are called Division 40 items, have varying rates from 5% up to, some cases, 20%. So there's different schedules of that. And I think in one earlier podcast, I gave you a list of the most recent apportionment and split of those highly depreciable items. So as you can see, properly claiming depreciation can offer you enormous benefits. And I think if you need any help organising a tax depreciation schedule for any of your properties that you've acquired in the past couple of years, just let me know and I'll help you in organising that.
Presumably some investors starting out may not have sufficient ready cash or perhaps are lacking in a little confidence. Is it possible for them to join up with other like-minded investors?
Yeah, you're right. Sometimes people don't have enough funds. Invariably, what they tend to do is form a partnership, which is probably the worst thing you can do because that exposes you to liabilities for the other party. What is best is to enter into a private syndicate, and the vehicle to use is a unit trust. Now, under the ASIC rules, a private syndicate cannot consist of more than 20 members, and it also is not allowed to raise more than $2 million in equity. Now, there's an exemption to those rules, and that is for so-called sophisticated investors. And those are investors who are earning over $250,000 a year and I think have net assets of $2 million themselves. So they don't count in the 20 of members. So you can have them in addition. But what happens then is that you form the unit trust and it is the members who appoint the trustee, which is generally a corporate trustee. The members choose the commercial property itself and they decide when and if the property should be sold. So maybe if I just give you a few guidelines of how I've helped clients in the past set up some very successful private syndicates. The setup, as I said, is best done with a unit trust, and that is for legal and taxation reasons, which we don't have time to go into now. But it also provides a shield from potential liability issues down the track. Now, as far as funding is concerned, your total borrowings for an investment should not exceed 65% of the total purchase price plus your other expenses. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that it means that the income on the property should comfortably cover the interest on your loans. In other words, it's positively geared. Now, if you want to have negatively geared, you can then borrow through a line of credit, the equity that you put into the trust. But as far as the trust is concerned, it is positively geared. So there's only 65% borrowing. Now, the second reason is that it means that you can then arrange what's called a non-recourse loan. And that means that members are not required to provide personal guarantees for the loan. Because the problem with personal guarantees is that when you have a group of investors, if one defaults, the others, if he can't or she can't meet her responsibility, become liable. So a non-recourse loan is very important. Now, unless otherwise agreed, the trust deed should have no requirement for investors to provide any further capital apart from their initial upfront contribution. So the next question arises, is the selling of units within the trust during the life of the trust? Because people get concerned about that. Now, I recommend that there be a formal review by syndicate members every 4 years and a positive decision is made to hold the property. Now, if the majority want to hold the property, but there's 25% that don't, then the trust deed should provide that the trustees have to buy out the minority shareholders that don't want to continue. When it comes to buying a property and choosing the property, certain criteria, sure, we've discussed these sort of things before, but it needs to be suitable for office, retail or industrial use, satisfy all the legal and town planning requirements, have minimal ongoing maintenance because that's something you don't want to really have to get involved with, and be reasonably new to ensure that you can maximise your depreciation benefits. As far as locations are concerned, I would suggest within the metropolitan areas in and around Australia, with a preference given to those proven locations for that specific market sector. And as far as exclusions are concerned, I would say you ought not be buying properties of a speculative or specialised nature, and also any of the properties that are yet to be built, in other words, off the plan, because that introduces a number of unnecessary risks for passive investors like having to find a tenant on completion. So in all of this, you have to understand you do need to still get professional advice to ensure that you fully understand the workings of a syndicate that you're going into.
Whether you're part of a syndicate or investing by yourself, I guess you still need to have an overall plan going forward.
Yeah, look, whether you're buying as a group or individually, when you're just starting out, your aim ought probably be to secure a worthwhile property. However, to be truly successful, you need to have a master plan. And maybe to help you there, I'll give you 6 steps that perhaps come to mind that would help. We've discussed it before, but your very first step needs to be to have an exit strategy. Now, this might sound a little strange when you're only just about to buy the property, particularly if it's your first property. However, you need to be looking forward and anticipating things like emerging trends, your lease expiry dates, changing economic circumstances, and the timing of any significant expenditure that may be required on the property in the future. Now, secondly, you need to remember that it is just an investment. In other words, you need to care, but not too much, because as soon as you start to fall in love with the property, you've got problems, because there are going to be circumstances change down the track, and then you have to be prepared to part with it without having any remorse whatsoever. Now, the third step would be to set a time for a formal review. Now, many passive investors would prefer to simply buy a commercial property and then squirrel it away in the filing cabinet. But as I mentioned a moment ago with a syndication, I feel every 4 years would be a good time to carry out a formal review of where the property sits within the marketplace and within your own portfolio. And that won't necessarily mean that you need to sell it, but it may. And what's more important for you is to consider the decision to hold the property for 4 years. So in other words, you make that positive decision to hold it rather than see whether you should sell it. The fourth area is you need to understand that the past is not the future. With commercial properties, things will change over time, such as the recent good performance in one sector doesn't always mean that that will continue. And therefore, you need to understand how the cycles vary for each of the sectors. In other words, office sector is generally an 18-year cycle, whereas industrial is a 9-year cycle, and retail is generally about a 3-year cycle, so 3 to 6 year cycle. So it's important you understand that and keep in mind that things do change. The fifth area you need to look at is to recognize why values increase. Now, as you can appreciate, an ongoing investment, its value results from 2 key factors: regular increases in your net rent and a fall or firming in the capitalization rate over time. So you need to keep a close eye on these things. You know, things like a looming oversupply of space within that sector, interest rate movements, particularly if you're looking at retail, because that is more sensitive than industrial and certainly the office market. And also, as I said, where your current position is in the growth cycle. So probably while you might have a 4-year formal review, if a lease falls due and you renew it at a good rental and you feel you're 2 years out from the end of the cycle, in other words, for example, the current cycle I think is probably going to peak in about 2020. So if you had a lease renewal in 2018, got a decent increase, a brand new 4 to 5 year lease, well, I would seriously consider putting it on the market, because even though you're 2 years out, by the time you market the property for a couple of months, you settle, there's another 3, there's 6 months gone already. So at least it leaves the purchaser with 18 months before the market peaks. Okay, you might have hung on for another 6 months, but I remember my grandfather said it's very difficult to sell commercial property in a falling market. So sometimes the perception of blue sky is actually worth more to you than the reality. So if you sell it at a point where a brand new lease, an escalating market, you're lucky to get a lot of value out of it. And okay, you stand out of the market for 12 months. When the market turns, there's two ways to make money, buying low and selling high. The other way is to sell high, and when the market turns, to buy low. So just keep an eye on that. And the final point I'd say is I would keep away from speculating. Sure, big money can be lost, it can be made, but can also be lost. You ought not look to trade commercial property in the same way as you might do with shares or futures. When you make your initial assessment to purchase a property, it really should be over a four-year time frame. Now, the reason I say that is because if you can get a worthwhile after-tax return on your equity, and in my view, that ought to be a minimum of 10%, and that's over a four-year period, that is a good purchase, and you might well hold it longer, but that's a good period to do it because you've got your maximum ingoing and outgoing expenses in that calculation. You've got your acquisition costs, stamp duty, legals, etc., and your selling costs, again, commission, advertising, and so forth. And that's spread over only a four-year period. Now, if it makes sense over 4 years, then it's going to be even better over a longer period. So I would say 4 years is a good time. Trading any less than that, the cost, ingoing and outgoing costs, are going to prove prohibitive.
As usual, you've given us more than enough to think about. And I look forward to seeing you again next week.
Yeah, and me too, Ken.